Well, this afternoon I would like to continue our series on biblical manhood and womanhood. This will be part two for those of you who are counting. There will actually be four parts of this series. The subtitle for the sermon this afternoon is The Masculine Man. The Masculine Man. In our first series on this general topic of biblical manhood and womanhood, we asked the question, what happened to men, to women, to fathers and mothers, to marriage and to family, especially here in America? We began at the Garden of Eden. We took a brief historical tour, ending up describing the sea of confusion surrounding the roles and responsibilities of men and women, quoting numerous sources, including Fatherless in America by David Blankenhorn and The End of Men by Hannah Rosen. Today, I would like to focus upon men, but we hope the ladies will stay and remain engaged because we want to talk about men and masculinity. What does biblical manhood look like? In contrast to what we discovered in the first sermon in this series, as well as what we see around us in our culture and in our society today. And as we begin to delve into the subject of biblical manhood and masculinity, let's go back to the Garden of Eden, if we may, and let's establish some basic points regarding God's design and plan for men. And we can't do that, number one, unless we do go back to the Garden of Eden, and number two, God's plan and design for men included women right from the start. And we'll see that man was not complete or whole. He needed a complement, and God created the perfect complement. And we shall see this as we continue through the sermon this afternoon. It will be impossible for me to discuss the topic of manhood and masculinity without talking about females and women and their impact and impression and effect upon men and their development of masculinity and maleness, if you will. You know, there's a difference between simply being a man by gender and then progressing toward the development of biblical manhood, a real sense of godly masculinity as you fulfill your God-given role as your gender reflects it, a male. And so there are some interesting corollaries here in the book of Genesis that give us an opportunity to determine what God's intention was from the beginning. We can't know everything for sure about this very complex and challenging subject, but we can pick up some basic principles that will help us develop some observations that I hope will guide us toward a deeper and better understanding of what it means to be masculine, to be a man, and to conduct yourself as God intended from the beginning. So I'd like to begin in verse 26 of Genesis, the first chapter, where God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." Now, we discussed this before when God said, "Let us make man," that is, mankind. So as he created them, male and female, I want you to notice he didn't necessarily create them as husband and wife. They were created male and female first, just as you and I come out of the womb, either male or female first. Marriage is a relationship that males and females can, of their own volition, enter into at an appropriate time in their lifetimes and in their development. But when God sets the precedent and gives the guidelines and the characteristics of manhood, he is not simply speaking to husbands. It's not always in the context of marriage. Much of it is. But even those comments that are given to guide us in terms of understanding real masculinity Those guidelines, yes, are given in the context of marriage in many respects, but there is much that we as men can glean, apart from being husbands, much that we can learn about our responsibilities and obligations as masculine men, even though many of the guidelines are given in the context of marriage, as we shall see. And in fact, in the fourth part of this series, I will get into some of those relationships and situations and how the principles that we're going to discover in the next two sermons fit into the overall plan of God and into our personal lives on a daily basis. So that will be discussed on down the road a little bit. Notice that mankind, both male and female, were made in the image of God. There is no hint or no clue in the book of Genesis that one was superior to the other. Now, that's disappointing for many of us men to accept, but there is no indication that man is superior to woman or that woman is superior to man. God said, "Let us make man or mankind in our image after our likeness." They both complement each other. And when you speak of being complementary, you don't speak of competing. You don't speak of who's better than whom. Who can jump higher? Who can run faster? Who's stronger? Who's prettier? Who's more handsome? Who's this? Who's that? We get into a lot of this as human beings. But this is not the case in the creation of man and woman. God created them both in His image and after His likeness. Male and female made us to be complementary, combining in such a way as to enhance or emphasize each other's qualities. They were both created to have dominion over other aspects of the creation. They were created to be the dominant force in the created world that God established, in the physical creation. And God pronounced this all very good. Verse 31, "Then God saw everything that He had made, and indeed it was very good." In Genesis 2, verse 18, "And God said, 'It is not good that man should be alone. I will make a helper comparable to him.'" I will make a helper comparable to him. A complement, something that makes you whole. What is a good way to describe something that is complementary? Well, if you have wine and cheese, each complements the other, and together they make a very pleasing combination. Now, they're not so bad separately, right? Some of you may prefer one over the other, but when you put them together, you get the full impact. And that's the way it is with male and female. That's the way God designed it. Males have things that females don't have as far as attitudes and approaches and personalities and sensitivities. It works both ways. We are different, and yet we're the same in terms of being part of mankind, made in the image and likeness of God. And the creative ingenuity of God in making male and female shows us that even His makeup is quite expansive, and it took two separate genders to reflect His image and His likeness, and we cannot, in and of ourselves, as either males or females, reflect God's full image unless we are together and complementing each other, supporting each other, filling in where the other has weaknesses or shortcomings. That was God's intent from the beginning. It seems very clear. As we read here, "It is not good that man should be alone." Now, He's speaking, of course, of the male gender, and I think that's especially important to note. I don't know that it would be good for woman or women to be alone either in this case. I think it's good that we have each other in the creation to support and encourage one another. But I think it's interesting to note that God made it a point to say it is not good that man should be alone. Man was made first. He was created first. And the creation order is mentioned in 1 Timothy. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But man or Adam was created first. God said it is not good that man should be alone. Anyone that has ever raised sons knows that. You know that. I walked out of my house many years ago now, and I looked outside, and I saw one of my sons and his friend ready to light some gasoline that they had put into a can, and they were going to do some tremendous experiment, apparently, of flammable liquids and cans and flying objects. And fortunately, I rescued them and my house from certain destruction. But boys, and sometimes men left to themselves, can get themselves in trouble. I think most parents would recognize that. And if most of us as men were honest, we would admit the same thing. We sometimes need a governor, a throttle, a management tool that can encourage us to go in a different way. Men are not omniscient, although many times we feel that we were gifted in that way. It is not good for man to be alone. It is just not good. Now, I want to make sure that in speaking to this subject, I don't want to necessarily make a statement that indicates that God expects every man to be married, and therefore, if you're not married, you are alone. Well, the last time I looked, there are over, 300 million people here in the United States and billions of people around. You are not alone. You are not alone. Sometimes we feel alone, and it is good to have friendships and other relationships. In other words, I don't want to hold out marriage as the only way aloneness can be addressed. But it is one of the primary ways, and when you begin to see what marriage really entails, it is a very challenging relationship, probably the most difficult relationship a man and a woman could ever enter into. And those of you that have been married or are married could probably attest to that. It is not easy. And, of course, in that relationship, there are some other factors that make it challenging, and we'll talk about that in a moment. So verse 19, out of the ground, the Lord God formed every beast of the field, every bird of the air, and brought them to Adam. And the whole thing was reinforced. Adam named every animal, and each one seemed to have a partner, a counterpart. He didn't. He looked around. He was all alone. God grabbed a rib and made Eve and presented her to Adam. It was a miraculous event. And, of course, God introduced the first woman to the first man and performed their wedding ceremony. That was a natural consequence of the situation here in the book of Genesis. But again, as life expanded, as the population grew, there were, of course, males and females all over the place, and families were established. Be fruitful and multiply was part of the reason why God established sexual relations and established marriage. We talked about that some last time. Now, males, as I mentioned, benefit from the modifying, refining, sensitive, caring impact of females that influence them and encourage them, balance them, and complement them. And marriage is the ultimate expression of that kind of relationship. Now, I want you to notice as well, there are multiple varieties of male and female relationships that we encounter in our lifetimes, aren't there? You can remember going to school, right? You can remember your kindergarten teacher. You can remember certain other people that you came in contact with. If you're a boy, you encountered the first woman in your life was your mother, right? Then grandma, then maybe you had sisters, then maybe you had school teachers. In other words, as we grow and mature, we engage in relationships with the opposite gender, the opposite sex. Male and female come together. We are not alone. We are complementary. We see that. We understand that. We experience that as we grow and as we mature. And, of course, these relationships are very important, and they can and should be rewarding. They are friendships. They are working relationships. They are familial relationships. You have a relationship with your aunt, your cousins. There are many different ways that you connect and relate to members of your own gender or sex and members of the opposite sex. These are all relationships in which the principles of manhood and womanhood can and should be exercised. However, marriage is a unique bond and union, for in this particular relationship between a male and a female, the two of them are to become one. The two of them are to become one. And that's what raises it to the next level. The marriage relationship has the unique purpose of reflecting the relationship between Christ and the church. And in many ways, it is the most challenging of all male-female relationships. The powerful sexual drives of both male and female were designed to be exercised within the bonds of marriage to unite and bind husband and wife together as one, and, of course, to provide the mechanism whereby they could be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth. Sexual relations were never designed to be recreational or random in nature. They were designed to be exercised and enjoyed in marriage with the command to be fruitful and multiply in mind, and we could dwell on that subject at length. If we chose to do so, because that, of course, has been something that mankind really, I wonder if we have ever understood that principle or that concept. And certainly today, the concept of recreational sexual relations is rampant. And to even mention the fact that sexual relations should be restricted to marriage is somewhat old-fashioned and out of date. And where did you get that relic? And we've evolved beyond that, etc., etc. The man, notice here in verse 24, therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall be one flesh, or become one flesh. And even Adam speaks to the oneness of the marriage relationship when he speaks of Eve as being bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. Now, isn't it thoughtful of God to create Eve from the rib of Adam? And Adam makes this statement, and who knows if he understood the depth of what he was saying, but of course it reflects the oneness that husband and wife are to achieve. And what a phenomenal reminder of that, as he recognized that a rib was taken from him, Eve was created. He said very clearly, she is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, or isha. In Hebrew, the Hebrew word for man is ish, because she was taken out of man. And of course, out of a woman comes a man in the birth process. So you have a sort of a complementary concept going on there as well in the creation as God designed it. So the man takes a leadership role in the relationship, verse 24, by leaving his father and mother and being joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And so the man, as we are going to see, is held responsible for taking those kinds of steps in terms of developing the marriage relationship, making the commitment necessary, leaving his father and mother, putting his wife first, joined to her, becoming one with her. He is expected to take the lead in that process and in that activity. And of course, it's assumed that the wife would leave her father and mother as well, that both would put each other first in this new relationship. Now, I would like to pause here and mention something that I hope will become obvious as we continue to examine this subject. God created and designed the man to assume a leadership role in male, female, and husband-wife relationships. How that leadership role is exercised is of supreme importance in really understanding biblical manhood and womanhood. And even the mere mention of the male gender being designed by God for a leadership role can prove to be offensive to women in our 21st century. Am I correct? I believe I am. And I don't wish to offend anyone. I simply wish to go through the Scripture and show God's intention from the beginning. And if you will stay with me long enough to the last installment, we will talk about how this should be working in real life. And in fact, it has rarely worked in real life down through 6,000 years because men have not understood these truths. And the first man and the first woman rejected them in a rather dramatic and unusual way, as we're going to see here in just a moment. In fact, the incident with the serpent in chapter 3 is remarkably similar to the conditions that men and women are confronting today in terms of role reversal. And we're going to see that here in the garden as we take a look in just a moment. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, I'm going to just briefly refer to this and then go back to the creation account, because Paul here in writing to Timothy referred and reflected back upon creation. In verse 12 of 1 Timothy 2. Now, Paul was addressing Timothy, the young evangelist. He was addressing undoubtedly an issue that had arisen in the congregations that Timothy was overseeing. And he said in verse 11, "Let a woman learn in silence with all submission." And I want to put that in context in the future, which we will do both next time when we talk about biblical femininity and feminism and womanhood and a woman's role. We will see that what Paul was referring to here is not perhaps as harsh as it might sound in verse 11. And I submit to you and suggest to you that this is another one of those inspired verses of the living God that proved to be offensive to many women today. And I think it's unfortunate, and I hope that we can, through the help of God's Holy Spirit and His inspired Word, begin to understand more of the appropriate way to approach this very important subject. Verse 12, "And I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence." This is in a church or a congregational setting. "For Adam was formed first, then Eve." So there is apparently something to do or something important about the created order. God intended something to be communicated by the order of creation. In verse 14, "Adam was not deceived, but the woman, being deceived, fell into transgression." Eve was deceived, yes, but in a sense, Adam's transgression was even greater. And we're going to see that in just a moment. "Nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, holy, and holiness with self-control." This is speaking of all of womankind, or every female, because the curse on Eve following the transgression or the sin of partaking of the forbidden fruit, if you will, had to do with bearing children. So let's go back to Genesis chapter 3. I just wanted to show you that Paul referenced it in the New Testament, so certainly it has significance for us today. And I want to try to put it a little bit more into the context of Genesis 3 as we go back. So let's take a look now in the book of Genesis, chapter 3. I'm going to make just a few observations here as we take a look at this chapter. First of all, the serpent chose to approach Eve first. That was undoubtedly a conscious choice by Satan. And I'm suggesting that quite possibly, and I guess, again, much conjecture can occur within chapter 3 because the information is so sparse. We have just the barest minimum that gives us a story flow of what occurred. We don't have a lot of the details. We can try to fill some of them in, but much of it is speculation, and some more plausible and reliable than others, perhaps. But in this case, the serpent clearly chose Eve first, no question about it. Where was Adam? Where was Adam? Where was the provider? Where was the leader? Where was the protector? Was he absent by choice, or did the serpent simply choose a time when he was not around? He was not there. And in fact, when he did show up, he wasn't there either. He failed in his leadership responsibility. Adam accepted Eve's offer to eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He failed to fulfill his leadership role, and Eve usurped that leadership role. In other words, Eve listened to the serpent, believed the lie, "This is the tree that will make you wise. It will make you like God. You can choose good and evil for yourself. God lied to you. You won't die. In fact, you're going to really live if you eat this fruit." God wasn't telling you the truth. He's holding back something from you. "I want you to take of this fruit. I'm your friend. This is going to help you. This will break the domination of God, and you won't have to obey him. You can choose for yourself. You'll be as smart as he is." And she took it. She believed it. And Adam listened to her instead of guiding her and informing her and directing her and encouraging her and pulling her away from that situation. So therein was his error and mistake. Paul was not addressing that in 1 Timothy because there were issues in the congregational setting that we'll talk about later. But here is a classic role reversal. Eve took the lead. Here, Adam, you take of the fruit as well. You will want to be smart like me. God did lie, and we are going to be able to choose right from wrong ourselves. And so he succumbed to the pressure of his wife, which is not unusual, is it, gentlemen? Because females can have a tremendous influence on males. Wives can have a tremendous influence on their husbands. That's why it is so important for husbands to lead in a godly fashion and to love their wives. And on the other side of the coin, it is important for wives to respect and honor their husbands. And when that combination of love and respect is working together in any male-female relationship, but especially in marriage, it is gangbusters. It is the concrete that holds you together and keeps you going down the right path and the right road that builds your relationship and brings you together as one. And look at the power of the snake to wiggle his way in there and completely explode it in almost no time at all. Unbelievable, and he will still try to do the same thing in marriages and relationships today. Now, I want you also to notice that Eve ate first, did she not? But when God came looking in the garden, who was he looking for? Was he looking for Eve? Verse 9, the Lord God called to Adam and said, "Where are you?" And he could have easily said, "Where were you?" Because "where are you" is not nearly as relevant, right, in this whole situation. It's "where was he" when he should have been the leader? Where are you, Adam? So this is indicating, again, God holding Adam accountable as the leader, as the responsible party. Where are you, Adam? And notice, because, God told Adam, you have heeded the voice of your wife. In other words, you did not lead. You followed. Now, don't misunderstand this. It is not wrong for a husband to listen to his wife. In fact, it's very important for husbands to listen to wives, because they can compliment you. They can give you additional information and a different perspective that you may not or do not naturally have. But in this case, Adam listened to his wife, who was telling him to disobey God. And you don't listen to anybody or anything. A snake, your wife, your buddy, no matter who it is, you don't listen to people who tell you to disobey God, who call God a liar, who dismiss the laws and commandments of God. Because you have heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree. Again, that's what he told Adam. There is no mention of Eve who ate first. In fact, there's no mention of eating the fruit when he talks to Eve. He simply says to the woman in verse 16, "I will greatly multiply your sorrow." We'll get there in a minute. To Adam, he said in verse 17, "Because you have heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you, saying, 'You shall not eat thereof.'" And who knows? We have just the barest of essentials, but maybe Adam intervened. "Well, excuse me, but didn't Eve eat first, and it really wasn't my fault?" Well, that's the same thing he basically said later, because he blamed it all on Eve. And, "Well, you know, it's the woman you gave me." Now, did God believe that? Did that buy Adam any leniency? No, because God held Adam responsible. Again, I bring these things out to show the leadership role that God designed for males, for men, for husbands, for masculine characteristics. Leadership should be one of them. But what kind of leadership? We have to define it. We have to describe it. The curse upon Eve focused on her primary role as the bearer of children and the nurturer of the family. Notice, verse 16, "To the woman, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children." I would suggest that the pain of childbirth is both literal, although none of us as men have ever experienced it. I have seen it 3 times, and it is painful. But it is also painful, if you will, to bring children into this world and to see the consequences and the results that sadly occur from the devastating shooting and the loss of young life in Connecticut to wars, in fact, to Cain killing Abel. Can you imagine the sorrow of a mother of 2 sons, one of whom murders the other? So I think it's a double-edged sword, the misery and suffering and pain that would be a part of conception and birth. And notice, your desire shall be for your husband. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Your desire toward your husband will be explained, of course, and has been explained in many different ways. I don't know if we will be able ever to fully understand it until God really describes it to us. But there are many different explanations that have been offered. I will offer you a couple that seem plausible to me. In other words, now, Eve, you are going to be in conflict with your husband. There's going to be conflict. There's going to be tension and strife in your relationship. It is not going to be the calm, loving, you are bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. Can you imagine the conversation that Adam and Eve may have had after they left the garden? You know, I wish you never would have given me that fruit. Why did you listen to that snake? It's the same conversation you have in the car with your wife on the way home when something happens like that. And so the relationship was transformed by this. And I don't know if words can really describe it. You will suffer conflict with your husband. You will be dominated by your husband is another way that these words could be understood. And if I could think of one word that describes my impression of what men have, if you will, done to women over the history of mankind, it would be to dominate them and to use them in inappropriate ways. And we could list many of those, even some that are still going on today. Even pornography is a disgusting abuse of women. And I don't know if men have ever really understood how to treat women, nor do I really believe that women have ever universally understood how to treat men. I think we have both gone astray. And to return to the biblical standard would be a wonderful and refreshing breath of fresh air. But you see how the relationship was transformed here. And you see how it came about and the role reversal that we talked about and the consequences of Eve's act and, of course, Adam's as well. Note how Eve's relationship again would change with her husband. And that's the sad reality of what we see here. In the 21st century, it's as plain as the nose on your face, just as it has been in centuries gone by. Now, on the other hand, as far as women's the female's treatment of the male and women treating men, some women have chosen to go head-to-head with men in the workplace and in the home, challenging their roles, diminishing their importance, degrading their contributions, and dismissing their impact. Couple that with the gender-blending trend towards same-sex marriages, and you have a recipe for disaster. The impact of these curses, and let me, before I leave, talk about the curse a little bit that Adam experienced. It says in verse 17, "Cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the herb of the field, and in the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you're going to return." And so it would seem that the primary focus of Adam's responsibility was to be a provider. And it would be very difficult for Adam to provide. He would have to work by the sweat of his brow. Thorns and thistles would come up. So you see, it is understood from the emphasis on the way God dealt with them following their transgression. He dealt with them in their primary role. Eve as the nurturer and the mother, Adam as the leader and the provider. And those are the roles that they had prior to the sin of eating the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The impact of these curses on mankind's ability to grasp, much less fulfill their roles as males and females, husbands and wives, is beyond description. No wonder we are adrift in a sea of confusion over the proper roles and relationships of males and females, men and women, husbands and wives. Now, at this point, I would like to interject a definition of masculinity in broad and general terms. Then I would like to move to the New Testament and expand on that definition of masculinity by bringing in some verses and supporting the general description or definition that I'm about to read to you here. Because there are distinctive directives for men that God inspired to be preserved in His Word, not just for husbands, but for men, for males. The essence of masculinity, here is my own shot or attempt at defining it. The successful progression from physically strong, sexually aggressive, somewhat irrational and incompetent, toward a benevolent, non-threatening, humble, caring, charitable, well-meaning, kind, unselfish approach toward others, especially females. A sincere desire, a sense of duty and obligation to lead, guide, protect, and provide for females in ways appropriate within the context of his various relationships, especially with females, his mother, sister, grandmother, female friends, teachers, fellow employees, and if married, his wife. So that is my attempt to define the essence of masculinity. Of course, there are many different aspects we could dwell on. And you'll notice I talk about the successful progression because young boys are often physically strong, sexually aggressive, somewhat irrational, and incompetent of making rationally well-thought-out decisions. And as they realize that testosterone is not the same as intelligence, and they begin to sand off those rough edges and become more mature, more caring, more conscious of the world around them and other people around them, and they note females not as objects of desire, but as creations of God, made to complement them and to encourage them and to make them whole and complete as far as their personality and their approach, they begin to approach females in an entirely different way. Not as chattel, not as someone to satisfy some desire, but as a valuable friend and ally in this business of becoming mature. And you see, it is very challenging to a male who is seeking to develop this kind of masculinity, a sense of duty and obligation to lead, guide, protect, and provide, when females say, "I don't need your stuff. I can do this by myself. I don't need you." I've never met anybody who enjoys being told they're not needed. Have you? That can be very harmful and very hurtful. And you can tell a man he's not needed by many intangible ways, nonverbal ways. And herein lies one of the great challenges we face in the 21st century. You heard the statistics last week. More females are graduating from college. More females are now in these kinds of positions. Their income is higher. On and on it goes. What am I saying? All females need to quit their jobs and give their good jobs to men. That's not the answer. The answer is far more complex than that. And these are the kinds of things we want to talk about as we get into the application of these concepts. Turn with me, please, to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Verse 3. Now, when you read the language of the Apostle Paul and try to put it in the context of the 21st century, you can see why feminists have tried to rewrite the Bible or discount it. There's got to be an answer that rings true and an answer that does not divide the genders. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 3, "But I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ. The head of woman is man, and the head of Christ is God." Now, we're going to talk about that. We're going to see how that should impact our relationships, be it male-female, be it husband and wife. Notice verse 7. And really, the verses 7 through 12 give a little more context to that concept. Listen to Paul, verse 7. "For man indeed ought not to cover his head, since he is in the image and the glory of God." He is in the, you might say, the role of Jesus Christ. That's what Paul said in Ephesians 5. "Love your wives as Christ loved the church." The man was created for the woman, but the woman for the man. The man was not created for the woman, but the woman for the man. There was a reason for that, and we're going to talk about that balance and that order of creation. Men should not have a symbol of authority on their heads because of their position. And, of course, as it says here, the woman is the glory of a man. Now, you look at the history of male-female relationships and tell me how many years, what percentage of human history have women been the glory of men? It's a sad commentary. A sad commentary. "For this reason, the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels." This is one of the most difficult phrases to understand, and I have no real answer for you other than to consider that the, and of course, we've always understood this to be speaking of hair length, longer hair, reflecting a woman's willing submission and fulfillment of her role as God intended, as a symbol of authority on her head, because she is a woman under authority, and the angels even recognize her submission and her respect for authority, and our guardian angels are there at the ready to protect us. Could the implication be that women who reject their role in that regard and show disrespect to authority, be it Jesus Christ or their husband, what have you, are endangering themselves? I don't know. It's a very difficult phrase to decipher. Verse 11, "Nevertheless, neither is man independent of woman, nor woman independent of man in the Lord." God never designed us to be independent of one another. He designed us to be interdependent, cooperative, complementary, not competitive. Sadly, we never have, it seems, grasped that fully as the human race, have we? "For as woman came from man," Adam's rib, "so man comes through woman." But look, both of you come from God. So who's better? Okay, the man says, "Look, you came from me." The woman says, "Look, all men come from me." God says, "Look, the two of you, you both came from me." So could we stop this "my dog's better than your dog" discussion? I didn't design you for this, and yet that's where it went from the get-go, thanks to the snake. So, continuing, the beautiful, interdependent, complementary nature of the two. Each contributes to the other. Again, neither is a man independent of a woman, nor is a woman independent of a man. And yet, what is the first thing we generally want to do when we get upset with a member of the opposite sex? Well, we want to flex our independence, and if we're men, we want to establish our authority. Because after all, the Bible does say that the man or the husband is the head of the wife, and that the wife has to submit. And maybe some husbands over the years have maybe smacked their palm with their fist just to kind of reinforce their position, which is not appropriate. And I do it only for effect. It shouldn't be done. That's not what the Scripture is talking about. Headship, as Christ exercises it, is what the Scripture is talking about. We're going to look at that here in Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians 5, verse 22. Ephesians 5, verse 22. And once again, remember the formula that I talked about earlier. As husbands love, wives respect and submit. And as wives respect and submit, husbands love. And once you get that cycle going, it is a winner. And you just keep building and building, and things get better and better and better. But when the wife or the female disrespects and the male stops loving and being kind, then you have a downward progression. And that's the way it works. And in verse 22, Paul's instruction, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as also Christ is the head of the church. He is the Savior of the body. Christ was the kind of being that gave his life for his wife, the church. What kind of husband are you? And in a sense, what kind of man are you? If you're a masculine man, you have this sense of protector, a sense of leader, a sense of being willing to stand in the gap and defend and protect a female. Now, if she resists that and she doesn't want that and she, you know, pushes you aside, she's been in the weight room and she just throws you out. Again, that's her prerogative, but is that in keeping with the design God had in mind? It's being the head of your wife is not being the domineering, overbearing, dynamic, and powerful super husband. It is not that at all. It is reflecting the love of Jesus Christ in your marriage. You know, there are a couple of things about Jesus Christ that are true, that aren't true about you and me as husbands. Christ never has to apologize. Now, I hope there are no husbands, and really no men who think, you know, I never have to apologize because I'm the head. Well, that's not true. We all need to apologize, and of course Christ never sinned, but we have. All of us. And so we are not Christ. We are to emulate and to pattern our love for our wives and, generally speaking, our love for females after the same kind of attitude, self-sacrificing, giving, gracious, kind relationship that Jesus Christ has with the church. And in fact, we'll see here that marriage was designed to reflect that relationship, and we as husbands should be reflecting that in our marriages in terms of how we treat our wives. Verse 24, therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Now, there are going to rise questions about, well, what if my husband wants me to do this or that? You know, being subject to your husband is very difficult. I have no doubt that at times it's difficult for my wife, it's difficult for every wife. But there are ways to be subject without being used as a doormat. And I would interject this, and we'll talk a little bit more about this later. it is all the more reason to consider the importance of your selection of a mate and determining whether or not you wish to be married. Because you should, as a female, as a woman, you should not marry someone you don't what? Respect. And are willing to submit to. Why would you do that? And as a man, you should not marry someone that you don't deeply love and cherish and honor and want to protect and provide for. And if you marry someone who in the courtship phase has been pushing you away and doesn't want your protector, provider, leadership attitude, then you maybe should rethink marriage. And I wonder if in this day and age, if the roles have been so confused and so watered down that it's very difficult for a prospective husband and prospective wife to really get to know each other and understand the dynamics of a working marriage relationship, because there are so few good marriage relationships to view. And that's why a lot of young people simply aren't getting married. But my point that I made earlier, I want to emphasize again, you cannot discount the importance of being very cautious and careful about your mate selection. You don't want to wake up like Jacob. Behold, it was Leah. Somebody pulled a fast one on me. You want to know what you're getting into. You want to take it slowly. Marriage is not something you jump into. You want to check the depth, or you're going to break your nose, or worse, when you dive in. Going on here in Ephesians, husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. That's the kind of leadership we're talking about. Not put another log on the fire. Bring my slippers and the newspaper. That he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself, a glorious church. Remember, Paul referred in 1 Corinthians 11 to the woman being the glory of the man. That she should not have any spot or blemish. And here's the clincher. I've always been amazed at this. When God inspired Paul to write this, I have to wonder about us as husbands, as men. Because apparently the best way to get to us in terms of describing the kind of love we should have for our wives, well, it's the kind of love you have for your own body, men. That's kind of disheartening, isn't it? You think, again, that's why I define masculinity the way that I did. It's a progression from this kind of primitive male testosterone-driven attitude to a mature level that understands what it means to love. You love your wives as your own body. He who loves his wife loves himself. No one ever hated his own flesh, nourishes it, cherishes it, just as the Lord does of the church. See, that's the kind of love you extend to your wife, and that's the kind of honor that men should extend to women. And when that is reciprocated, what a joy it is to see relationships blossom and flourish. But sadly, in this world, it has rarely been tried. It's like that old quotation of Christianity. Remember that one? Christianity is not difficult. No, it's too difficult. No, Christianity is not difficult because it's never been tried. Why? I shouldn't have even started that because I can't remember the quote. But it's never been tried in its full impact. This business of men and women, husbands and wives. It was foiled from the beginning. It was polluted and distorted from the beginning. And I don't know that we've ever gotten it right. But as God's people, we need to work harder at getting it right. And again, for this reason shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Now, as I mentioned, how the husband leads is very important. If the leader, any leader, is surrounded by people who are smarter, more skilled, and capable than he is, he will listen to them and respond, bringing the strengths of all to the table to creatively solve problems, complete projects, make decisions. But if you are immature and testosterone-driven, what do you do if you have people around you that are smarter and more capable than you? Well, if they're your employees, you fire them. You want to get you don't want anybody to be smarter than you. They might take your job. That's not leadership. That's jealousy. That's competition. That's strife. It's not leadership. And as husbands, we need to recognize the talents and strengths and skills of our wives. As men, we need to recognize the talents and skills and abilities of women, and we need to capitalize on those. We need to ask for advice. We need to gather information. We need to respect one another. We need to love each other. And we need to build the kind of complementary relationships that God designed us to build and wants us to build. That should be our goal as men and women, as husbands and wives. Now, how important is the father's assertion of leadership in a family setting? I want to turn to Malachi chapter 4. Malachi chapter 4. Verse 5. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord, and he will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the earth with a curse. What does this tell you about the importance of a role of the father in the family? Now, God could have inspired anything he wanted to inspire. It sounds like utter destruction is going to come if the hearts of fathers are not turned back to their children and the hearts of children to their fathers. And is there any verse in the entirety of the Bible that more graphically describes the description of our modern 21st century America and families in America than this verse? I don't know of it. The hearts of fathers turned back to their children. The hearts of children turned back to their fathers. Fathers can have and do have a dramatic impact on their sons because they show their son how to be male, how to be masculine, and how to become a man. And if their son doesn't learn that or learns inappropriately and improperly and wrong things and does not have a good role model, then what happens? Men in their daughters' lives show young girls how men should value and honor them. Who is the first man that a young girl has a relationship with? I mean that, obviously, in an appropriate fashion. It's her what? Her father. So if her father doesn't show her respect and doesn't create in her a sense of value and worth and meaning and show her how important she is as an individual and how feminine she is and how worthy she is of being protected and provided for. And not that females can't protect themselves or provide for themselves. It's not a matter of physically putting up your dukes or making $1 million. It's all a matter of heart and attitude. And to be submissive to Jesus Christ, all of us have to do that. But if there's going to be leadership in a family, it's got to be leadership. It can't be anything else. And God designated the husband as the leader and the wife as his helpmate and his complement. That's the way marriage was designed to work. I'm not going to put molasses in my car on the way home. I've got to stop and fuel up. What's going to happen? Isn't going to work very well, is it? I don't want to do that. You ever had a car with molasses in it, Mr. King, in your shop?
Well, maybe not molasses, but sugary type stuff.
Yeah, so that's used to be an old way that pranks were pulled. In other words, follow the manual on marriage and on male-female relationships. It's going to work a lot better than your own concoction. And that's exactly what Eve did. She took it upon herself to overrule God. I know better than God. And here Adam, and Adam reneged on his leadership responsibility. And so that's why essentially we find ourselves where we are. Let me read just a few statistics here about children from fatherless homes. This is from Fathers Unite website. Children from fatherless homes are 15.3 times more likely to have behavioral disorders, 4.6 times more likely to commit suicide, 6.6 times more likely to become teenage mothers, 24.3 times more likely to run away, 15.3 times more likely to have behavioral disorders, 10.8 times more likely to commit rape, 6.6 times more likely to drop out of school, 15.3 times more likely to end up in prison while a teenager. 73% of adolescent murderers come from mother-only homes. Furthermore, 63% of youth suicides are from fatherless homes. 85% of all children that exhibit behavioral disorders come from fatherless homes. 85% of all youths sitting in prisons grew up in a fatherless home. Now, is that chance? Is that somebody bending statistics to make a point? Or are fathers really important? Fathers are really important. Mothers are really important. It is not healthy to discount one, to put one down and raise up the other. The end of men is not any more appropriate than the end of women, because it spells the end for both. And yet, our culture and society seems oblivious to that, driven by forces and powers that they aren't even aware of. In fact, the same force and power that drove Eve and captured her attention and distracted Adam. So in closing, I want to review that description of the essence of masculinity that I referred to earlier. And again, this is just my thing. I'm sure you could make one yourself that's probably more accurate or more definitive. The successful progression from physically strong, sexually aggressive, somewhat irrational and incompetent, toward a benevolent, non-threatening, humble, caring, charitable, well-meaning, kind, unselfish approach toward others, especially females. A sincere desire, a sense of duty and obligation to lead, guide, protect, and provide for females in ways appropriate within the context of his various relationships, especially with females. His mother, sister, grandmother, female, friends, teachers, co-workers, fellow employees, and if married, his wife. So next time, we're going to discuss femininity. The feminine woman. What are her general characteristics? What are her roles and responsibilities? What is the essence of femininity? What makes a female a female? And what was God's design and purpose for her from the beginning? And as I mentioned, in the fourth installment of this series, we will bring male and female together and discuss ways in which, whether single or married, males and females can relate to one another in a godly fashion.